You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Felix Cavalieri is a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame because he wrote and sang some of the greatest songs ever written as a member of the Young Rascals. Among his astounding catalog of hits are Groovin', Good Lovin', Beautiful Morning, How Can I Be Sure, and People Got to Be Free. Basically, the soundtrack of the lives of my generation. Felix Cavalieri's new autobiography is called Memoir of a Rascal, and I can't wait to get my hands on a copy. Felix Cavalieri, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
I'm sorry I haven't had the opportunity to read your book yet because they haven't sent it to me, but I saw that incredible photo on the cover taken by Linda McCartney. That's very cool.
It is cool. She was very cool. She was a lovely, lovely lady, and her estate gave us permission to use it, and I'm really thankful.
Where was that picture taken?
I think that was taken in a New York club called the Phone Booth. I may be wrong, but you know, Linda used to come around as a photographer in those days, in the early days before she met Paul. She would take great photos of a lot of the groups. As a matter of fact, she has, I think, at least two major photography books. You know, the kind that you put on your table.
Yeah,
and are fantastic, really fantastic.
Yes, she was great. She was great. I have to ask you this one question. My wife, oh, here it is. My wife wants to know if you remember her. Now, she attended a Young Rascal show at the World Theater in New Rochelle in 1966. She was that funny looking little girl. You remember her, don't you?
Of course, absolutely. I don't remember New Rochelle, but I remember her. Yeah.
This is her album. She's toted this album around.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, that's hometown for me. I grew up right next to New Rochelle. Pelham. I grew up in Pelham.
Yeah.
And of course, New Rochelle, right next door, right next door. Well, good.
Well,
that's really wonderful.
That record, The Young Rascals, recorded for Atlantic Records, which is a label that was known exclusively, really, for rhythm and blues and soul, Ray Charles and Ruth Brown, Otis Redding and Aretha Franklin. And Atlantic had a subsidiary label, ATCO, for acts like Sonny and Cher and the Buffalo Springfield and Bobby Darin. So how did you guys end up on Atlantic, even though you were white artists?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question. All I know is that I was really happy to be there because, you know, as you said, you know, three quarters of my music collection in those days was Atlantic Records. So it was a thrill. I don't know how they decided to do that. I'm just glad that they did. I think, seriously, what they were trying to do, you know, that was the era where the bands were coming in to play, like, you know, the Beatles and Stones and Kinks and Animals. And so I think they wanted to be part of that marketplace.
I want to ask you about the Beatles, since you mentioned them. You know, I think everybody obviously was influenced by the Beatles, but maybe the Young Rascals, more than any of the other bands of the era, kind of had a common ancestry in R&B rather than a direct Beatles influence, even though you guys had long hair.
Correct. But we had long hair because of them, I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah. Did you guys wear matching suits?
No, you know, we took a different tack, and it was really see, in those days, the clubs were 21 and over, and the proprietors demanded that you wear a jacket, a tie, and so we would do anything not to have to wear those. So I'm not sure who came up with, but someone came up with these costumes that we put on and said, "Whoa, we got these knickers. We can put those on." and the fellow we were working for at the time said, "That's fine. You still have to put a tie on." So we ended up with a tie and this outfit, which, anyway, we tried.
A tie and knickers.
Yep. Well, yeah, it was like Fauntleroy costumes.
Right, right. Because you were rascals. You were little rascals.
Well, we certainly were. Well, yeah.
Would you agree the Beatles were not like a direct influence in terms of musicality, or were they?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that's a different thing. But you see, what they gave to us meaning the entire music industry, was first of all the fact that they wrote their own songs. Now, you know, prior to that and to Bob Dylan, people went to publishing houses for their songs. They went and procured, you know, like that's how Neil Diamond and Carole King and all those people really started, you know. But Beatles wrote their own, so I said, well, why not? We can do that. Let's do it. I mean, you know, there's nothing like you to think you can climb any mountain. The other thing that the Beatles did that you know, like, I don't know if people are aware of it, but, you know, the radio stations had to play a Beatle record. They were very particular about, you know, what they would put on the air, but they couldn't do that with them. So when they did Michelle and Yesterday, I was able to do How Can I Be Sure, because they had already set the table for that type of music. That is something, you know, you just can't. You can't define what they did for us, you know, because of the fact that they opened up the ears to the public as well as the radio station promo people. What do you call that? Production people.
Yeah.
Okay, su guitarra. A strange, exciting thing about to be. I have a tingling feeling deep inside of me. I never felt.
I want to ask you about one of my favorite songs of yours, Swing You, because that record. Oh. That seems like a really genre-bending record, because it's a soul record, it's a Latin record, and it's a psychedelic rock song.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how far you go back, but do you remember a group called the Kingston Trio?
Sure.
Yeah. I was influenced by them, and they had that kind of ideas in some of their songs. You know, it was a folk band, but it was kind of like a college folk band. You know, they were not actually like, you know, mainstream folk. They were, you know, I don't know. The Latin community in New York has always played a big role in my head, because of the fact that when I first started, I went to the Catskill Mountains to play, and there was a tremendous influence there of Latin music for the summers. And it hit, you know, and helped me with Groovin', of course, and Sueño, and it was interesting.
Groovin' has a Latin beat as well?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's called a bayon, yeah.
Uh-huh.
That's a Latin.
Ah.
That's a Latin as you can get, pretty Latin.
Yeah. That's interesting, because, I think it's a song we've heard. It's one of those songs you can't even imagine that anybody ever wrote it, because it's a song that's been in our lives for so long. But you actually sat down and wrote it. How did it happen that you wrote that song?
Well, you know, there's always stories about songs, and they get better as the years go by. You know what I mean? Because, but the premise of that song was very simple: is that, you know, like, musicians work on Friday and Saturday nights. And, you know, this is what I say on stage. This is my shtick on stage. Okay. You know how many women like that? None. So if you want to show your loved one that you care, you groove on a Sunday afternoon. You write a song for her. See, it's simple, you know, when you break it down like that, because it's true. And truth is always the best, you know, the best thing to write about, because it's true. You couldn't see your lady on Friday and Saturday, but you could see her on Sunday afternoon.
It's a beautiful morning.
It's a Beautiful Morning. That's a record that I love to play in the morning. It's such a perfect morning record. It also was a record that I used to listen to a lot back at the times when we were altered. Was there drug influence in your music?
Not at that point. By that time, I had met a guru and kind of straightened my act out, you know. Mm. Now, basically, that was a exclamation of joy. You know, at that time, we had just followed Groovin'. We had, you know, 6 weeks number one in New York City and around the country, and we were in Hawaii, and everything was just, I mean, just magnificent. I said, I'd like to write a song so that basically you can feel this, what we're feeling, what I'm feeling right now, which is total bliss.
The air in Hawaii is in that song.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, and then the rest of the kind of like, you know, lyrical content, it tells a story that should support that, you know.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we are talking with Felix Cavallari. He's a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with his band, The Rascals. He's the man behind hits like A Beautiful Morning, How Can I Be Sure, Good Lovin', Groovin', People Got to Be Free. And he's just written a memoir. It's called Memoir of a Rascal by Felix Cavallari.
You had been in a few bands before The Rascals. So what were some of those bands that you were in?
Well, actually, I had my own band in college, which was called The Escorts. And then I went, as I say, to the Catskills, and I was kind of discovered there by this group, Joey D and the Starlighters, who had gone to England. I'm sorry, excuse me, had come to work at the Raleigh, and they had gone to Europe. And their organ player quit. Ah. And so they contacted me to join them. Well, that kind of made the decision whether I was going to go back to school or not, you know, because I was at Syracuse. I was a pre-med. And when I got there to, it was, matter of fact, Germany and then Sweden, this group opened up for Joey called The Beatles, which no one had heard of yet in the United States.
Wow. So you really saw them early on.
So I saw them, and you know, as I've been saying this, you know, but it's in my new book. But I saw the hysteria that the crowd had; they were just bonkers, and they were mostly female, so that already got my attention. Second of all, musically, second of all, the long hair, you know, which I never had seen, but the music was what kind of enthralled me because. You know, when they played American songs, they were like, okay. You know, they were like, okay, I understand these guys don't have too much ethnic blood. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, when they did their songs, there was a magic in the room that was so noticeable because, you know, no one had ever heard I Want to Hold Your Hand, Love Me Do. At least I hadn't in America. In Europe, they knew.
Yeah.
When that happened, when that came over across the microphone, what you could hear, it was just like, oh my God, listen to this. This is special. You just knew something was special here, you know, and that really was what made me decide to go into the music business. And, you know, as I say, the stories get convoluted over the years because it looked like a lot of fun, to say the least. It really did.
So the Beatles had more influence on you than I thought. So did you have a vision then of what the Young Rascals would be? You had a sound in your head and you wanted to get that band, or did you just come to those guys?
The story kind of goes around a little bit because the fact that, in those days we had this, I'm sure you people remember, this wonderful thing called the draft hanging over our heads. And, you either were married or you were in college or you were drafted. So right. It was pretty simple that I couldn't really, proceed on any type of a career until that was rectified, until that was, you know, either in front of me or behind me. So I stayed with Joey for a while. And then I was, you asked how many bands I was with. So I was with his bands called the Starlighters. And then I went to Las Vegas during that period of time. A young lady from Canada, contacted me and, we worked behind her. I did that with Lee Greenwood of all things. Lee was just coming up as well. Oh. And we were called the Scotties. We were Sandu Scott and the Scotties, and we wore kilts. And I'm sorry to say, you know, on stage, we looked a little silly, but anyway. And then I got drafted, and then after that was taken care of, I went back to what was Joey D's band, the Starlighters, and instead of going back to work, I asked the people who were there, which was three of us. There was Eddie Rigotti, myself, and Gene Cornish, who had just come in from Rochester. He came into Rochester, from Rochester to New York, to kind of make it in show business. Hit a wall and joined Joey's band in the club. And then I found this phenomenal drummer named Dino Danelli that actually a young lady introduced me to, and it really just blew my mind. And I asked them, would you like to give it a try on our own? And they said yes. So basically the only bands I've really been with.
Yeah. And then did things click right away? How long did it take until you got your first record?
You know, things click right away, man. Absolutely. The magic, you know, groups sometimes, you know, they may not have, you know, it's kind of like an all-star team, maybe a basketball team, you know. Just because they're all stars doesn't mean they're going to win. You know, there's a symbiotic, there's a kind of a relationship that passed the ball. Yes, it clicked from the very beginning. We had a deal within 6 months of inception of the group, which is kind of unheard of today. And during that period of time, Eddie had an accident, car accident, so we were laid up for a good 2 or 3 weeks, and you know, maybe could have been longer if his mom hadn't allowed him to go to the next place where we were discovered, which was called the Barge.
Mm. And did you guys get along?
A, yes. Now you want B and C? Well, that's another question. You know, that's the tragedy of groups. You know, like, I mean, seriously, there's, you know, I guess it's like a marriage. You know, you have this wonderful relationship, and your songs are your kids, and you know, yeah, you have this joyous thing, and then all of a sudden, the divorce papers come. You know, and you go like, "Oi, wait a minute, what's this?" Yeah. And you know, and you know, the only word you can really say is very disappointed that in fact happened. I really am.
Yeah, you wish that if you could go back, you would try to hold the band together longer.
Well, you know, it really wasn't up to me to do that. You know, your manager really is the one who, you know, he's the elder statesman, so to speak. It's his job or her job to, you know, keep the troops together, because, you know, we're all maniacs at that age. I mean, seriously, you have to, and you know, it's so interesting because the groups whose managers were able to do that and were able to, you know, govern intelligently, they're all super, super groups. You know, that management role is huge. Fortunately, I've got a young man now who comes from California, and the joke is this: if I was only born when you had the Rascals, and it's true, if we'd have had, his name is Obi, O-B-I Steinman, if we'd have had him in those days, yes. Yes, because he knew how to run a railroad, you know what I'm saying? And
yeah.
With all due respect, we had this wonderful man, Sid Bernstein. Sid Bernstein was, you know, he was the gentleman that brought the Beatles to the United States.
Right, yeah.
But there's a difference between being able to, you know, be the captain of a ship and, you know, own the ship, you know, or whatever. He just, the nuts and bolts, you know, weren't there with him. You know, he wasn't that type of manager. Now, Brian Epstein was, you know, and Peter Grant was from Led Zeppelin.
Right.
You know, they did. I mean, you never saw Led Zeppelin unless you paid. They were not on TV. That's will right. Not find a television show for Led Zeppelin. You want to see my band? Pay.
Yeah.
Interesting. You know, I mean, those kind of thoughts. And he's passed as well. But he did a heck of a job for those guys. I mean, those obviously.
Yeah. And I guess they had a 10-year run. And the Beatles had a 10-year run, although once Brian Epstein died, that really was sort of the beginning of the end for them, right? They needed.
Yeah, because then you're self-governing, and that doesn't work.
Right. I guess it's enough to make the art without having to be the manager of the art as well.
Well, not too many people can do it. You know, it's that right brain, left brain kind of idea that, you know, like there are newer artists such as Garth Brooks, you know, who's a marketing major, who really know what they're doing. But for the most part, you know, a lot of us in those days were I hate to say the word because people, you know, we were communists. You know, yeah. And I realized that communism may not work, you know. It might work. Yeah, one vote, one man, doesn't work.
On a Sunday afternoon.
You're going on tour with Mickey Dolenz this year, and yeah. he was a monkey, and he was part of the music scene that was blossoming in California, both in L.A. and San Francisco. And you guys were kind of an East Coast band. Were you was there an identity that made you East Coast, or did you feel kinship with the scene in California?
Well, there certainly was an identity for the East Coast bunch. You know, there's no doubt about that. Because I remember the first trip that we took to California. And you know, that was exactly in 1966, I think, when Good Lovin' came out.
Uh-huh.
And we did the Whiskey A Go-Go, and that cemented our number one record. Because you had to have the coasts united, you know, to sell at that level to be a number one. But yeah. I noticed when we went to California, and I think I put this in the book as well, because at that time, Los Angeles was really La La Land. It was really gone, man. And I'll never forget it. There was a club across the street called The Trip.
Oh, yeah.
And they were not kidding. You know, people were literally dancing by themselves with costumes on. It was, and there was quite a difference between the East Coast and the West Coast. I mean, I'll never forget it as long as I live. I remember people coming to the show with like Superman outfits, and you know, like Tinkerbell was very prevalent out there. You know, it was really interesting for an East Coast bunch of kids to go to the West Coast. It was mind opening. You know?
Yeah, I guess the East Coast look was, you know, a black jacket and black pants, and the West Coast look was blue jeans and tie dye.
Well, that's a nice way of putting, you know, the insanity that was going on out there. It was really something. And you know, again, this is in my memoir, but I remember going back to the Sunset Strip not too long after that. Right when Governor Reagan became governor.
Yeah.
And they were all gone. They closed all the clubs. They closed all the street. And they went up to San Fran.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And you were there then, I guess?
I lived in L.A. then, and I went to see, I didn't see you guys, but I did see The Doors when they played it.
Absolutely. Well, they opened for us at the Fillmore, yeah.
Yeah. And,
well, there's a perfect example. They were out to lunch. I mean, you know, like I say, you know, I'll never forget it because, you know, here we come in with all this, you know, energy. And these guys were like, you know, the group that opened for us was Arthur Lee. I don't know if you remember.
Oh, yeah,
that. Sure.
Love,
that was it. Gone. You know, I'll never forget. And one of the guys that came in is that the fellow that wrote that, God, what was the name of that song about the revolution or something like that?
The Eve of Destruction?
Oh, my God. He came in. I'll never forget that. You know, it was a madhouse.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was just so, I mean, it was so much fun for us because, you know, it was like a new world, you know. And, you know, even the music in those days, you know, when you would travel around the United States, there would be little pockets of different types of music, you know, like yeah. New Orleans music and, you know, Chicago music, Detroit music, New York music. LA. Now, unfortunately, it's all the same. They've all been kind of like homogenized into, you know, the radio stations. That's it. It's done. You know, it's all the same.
It's a smaller world now, I guess. Yeah. But I mean, in L.A., the sound of, well, there was surf music and there was also like the Birds and the Buffalo Springfield sound, which was pretty radically different from the stuff that you guys were making, which was really rhythm and blues.
Yeah, and you know, the interesting thing is that we really weren't trying to make rhythm and blues. You know, it's kind of the same thing as my accent. You know, I live in Tennessee now, you know.
Uh-huh.
No, nobody really thinks that I live in Tennessee, you know. I mean, it's like
you still talk like you're from New York.
Exactly. It's the same thing when we would do a song, we would be sure we were doing it, you know, like the English did it, and just didn't sound like that. So, you know, we're just kind of identified by our voices, you know.
At a certain point, the Rascals became the Rascals, and they kind of, you kind of switched to being album artists from singles artists in a way. Is that true?
Well, the whole industry did.
Uh-huh.
You know, when we started, it was all about AM radio. And then as that transition happened to FM radio, the playlists, the time of the song went from 2 minutes to 30 seconds to, you know, now you could do 4 minute songs, 4.5 minutes. They'll never do that on AM radio. That'll never happen because, you know, they want to get those commercials in and stuff. So now, you know, to make that transition was difficult for us. It's really difficult because the audience identifies you with a certain type of sound, you know, a certain type of, output. And even though the group had split up and we went to Columbia, I really tried to expand to that FM type of genre. And, you know, the audiences, they're kind of like they lock on to something and that's it. You know, there's some exceptions, but not many. You know, most of the people, you know, Hall and Oates, they go back together. You know, the only ones really that have been able to escape that is, Sting and, of course, Paul McCartney. But you're talking the absolute top of the heap here, you know, so.
In terms of solo.
Even Mick Jagger, he went back.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we are chatting with Felix Cavallari. He's just written a memoir called Memoir of a Rascal, because he was one of the young Rascals, and he's the guy behind songs like A Beautiful Morning, Groovin', and People Got to Be Free.
All the world over side, easy to see.
Like, I was looking at this record, the Freedom Suite album, which I really love. And I wonder, who was first with this silver foil cover, you or Cream? I think you guys did.
I don't know. See, what we did is, when you have a group, especially, we were in almost complete control of our music and to a degree, the covers and all that because that's the deal that Atlantic gave us. They were the only label that allowed us to produce ourselves. I really wanted to produce the band ourselves.
Yeah.
Well, when you've got four kids, you know, you got to control the four kids, you know, somehow. Well, Dino really was the artistic guy. In other words, he started to study art. You know, not in school. He did that, you know, on his own, and he became quite an artist. So the covers were his. That was his province. That's him. So whatever he did, as long as the record company didn't mind paying for it, that was fine with me. I gave him the title of the album, and then you do the cover. You take.
Did anybody say you can't do a two record set or anything like that?
Oh, sure, they always say that. You know, I mean, like I say, you know, a friend of mine wrote a song which is really the epitome of the music industry, and it's called "It's Not the Money, It's the Money." Exactly, it's not the money. Yeah, anything that costs more than they question, because it's, you know, I mean, that's just the way it is. And especially in those days, Atlantic, you know, they were a small company in the beginning before Warner's took over, you know, and their budget, you know, they needed a hit. They didn't need extra expenditure.
When you first went into the studio, obviously they had producers, I imagine, who told you, you know.
No, they didn't. You see, that's the rub right there. We were in charge.
Right away.
Yeah, absolutely, from day one. However, this is where the divine guidance comes into the picture. They put these two gentlemen in the room with us who were legendary. One was Tom Dowd, and the other was Arif Mardin. It's the same as when the Beatles had their George Martin.
Yeah.
And the relationship that I had, especially with Arif, over those years, I will never forget as long as I live, because he was brilliant. He was an absolute gentleman. Tom was also very, 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 very important to us. However, he broke out and became a producer. He had been an engineer. And for those who like to, you know, do a little bit of research, look up these two gentlemen. They have documentaries in their name, Tom, D-O-W-D, and Arif Mardin, M-A-R-D-I-N. It's pretty fascinating what these men accomplished in their lives.
So would you say that they mentored you to record producing? Oh, and one of my favorite records is this one, Lauren Nero's record.
Absolutely,
Christmas in Beads of Sweat. And you are the producer of this record.
Yeah, and you know, she was a dear, dear friend. You know, she was probably the most unique artist that I ever met in my life, the purest artist I ever met in my life. She just really, you know, had no desire to hit the charts.
None at all?
None. And I said to her, I said, you know, darling, some of us would like to make some money around here. You know what I mean? She could care less.
Well, I think a lot of people thought that record was a Christmas record, which it's not.
Well, you see, that's a perfect example. Clive Davis, you know, told her, because she was in complete control. David Geffen was her manager. Uh-huh. Before he left, she had no one told her what to do, you know, including us, you know. But he told her, I mean, they said, look, if you put Christmas in the title, then after Christmas, they're going to take it off the shelves. It's gone. Guess what? Guess after what the title is?
After Christmas, they took it off the shelves.
Huh? She was, well, you see, if you look at her track record, the songs that she wrote were number one solos by other artists.
Almost all by soul artists, right? I mean, the Fifth Dimension.
Yes.
Going. Yeah. Of course.
Why? Because they took out those little nuances that, you know, she wouldn't take out. She wouldn't take them out. And so the radio station said, well, you know, we're not going to play that, you know, because we don't like stopping and going in the middle of a song. You know, we don't.
Right.
Like
she would change the time signature in the middle of the song.
Oh, she was magic, man. So the other people came along and they adhered to those rules that, you know, the radio stations had. They were kind of unwritten, but we all knew what they were, you know, and they had number one records. But that was Laura Nero.
Did you find her to be easy to work with, fun to work with, or what?
Not easy to work, but fun to work with. Uh-huh. Yeah, because she, like I say, she, you know, talent is really wonderful to be around, you know. And she would she became a dear friend of mine, and she would call me up in the middle of the night and just say, "Can I run a lyric by you?" I said, well, sure. As soon as I come to Earth, yeah. And she would run this lyric by me, and I had no idea. What are you talking about? I got to figure out your language. Is this, where's this from Mars? You know, she was just unique. So she was a joy. My kids adored her. My kids used to come to our home all the time. Mm-hmm. But as far as being easy to work with, no, I think that, you know, she was very adamant about what she wanted to hear. And if that didn't, well, I'll give you an example. Now, you know, when you mix a record, it usually takes quite a while, you know, because in those cases, we had basically two tracks, two left and right stereo channels to deal with. And we go to great lengths. We spend great amounts of money in the studio. She used to listen to the mixes on one of those little boxes that were red, that were mono, that you put in. Now, if it sounds good on that, wow. You know, but if it doesn't sound good, you have to go back in and do it all over again. Oh, my goodness. I mean, you can't make this up.
You took my heart, misery. You taught me blues. When I got a lot of patience, baby. That's a lot of patience to lose. I'm crying. I'm mad at my country. Now I've been treated bad. When I was a free boy and you were the main drag.
Your early Rascals records, were they in mono? They were
mostly
mono, yeah. And was there? Did you have anything to do with the stereo mix? This copy that I have, it says stereo, but I think the mono sound is the one we heard on the radio for sure.
That's an interesting story too, because that was the transition period between mono and stereo. And yes, I mean I was present at every mix and every dial that was touched, and you know I really wanted to learn, you know, what this was all about. And so the industry was learning what stereo was about. And, you know, Tom Dowd, as I mentioned, who the engineer, he was actually brought to Washington, D.C. by John F. Kennedy to do the press conferences in stereo. That's how advanced he was. I mean, you know, he was that level of intellect in the electronics world. Let's put it like that. You know, we would have people like Ray Dalby come in, you know, legendary Dalby. They knew him at that level, you know. And so, yeah, the stereo came in later. And unfortunately, we had to mix both mono and stereo, which really took a long time. And the interesting part of it, the fun part of it is, you're right, the radio stations could only play mono. But they came out with stereo. And what they did is they put on the flip side, they put a stereo version. And then on this side, they put a mono version. And so what would happen, we were all experimenting, you know, we left, right, center, that was all new. Yeah. So like, for example, in Good Love, you go one, and you don't hear the two because it's not there. Three, you know, because we didn't mix it correctly, you know. One, three, what happened to two? Oh. But those are the mistakes that people love, you know.
I thought you guys were just being cool.
We were being cool, right? Yeah, it was a great time, and there's so many advances, you know, in those years. Those were really the American Renaissance years. That hopefully, maybe one day they'll come back, and we'll have that type of talent around again.
When you were a kid, what did you study music formally as a kid?
Yes. I studied classically for 8 years. You know, I was very, very serious about it. My mom wanted me to be a classical pianist. And, you know, I really never even heard rock and roll until she passed. And that pressure was not on me to stay in that, in that secular world, you know, that was kind of like locked up to me. Mm. And then when I heard it because a friend of mine in school who was to become my friend asked me if I had ever heard rock and roll, and I said yes, but I had never heard it. Uh-huh. I went home and I heard Alan Freed's, you know, WINS rock and roll, which had just started, you know, in those years in New York. And it just really changed my entire perspective on music, because I heard people playing my instrument, the instrument that I played, it was a piano, but I never heard it played like that.
Yeah. Little Richard's approach was a little...
Little Richard, Fats Domino, Ray Charles especially, that just blew my mind. Because I just couldn't, what are you doing? You know, what is that? You know, and I really wanted to explore that.
So up until then, you'd only been listening to classical music. You didn't have...
Pretty much. Yeah. You know, I mean, of course, there was always music around the house. Like in those days, the TV had Perry Como, you know, and those. And of course, Elvis. We can't forget Elvis. Elvis... You know, blasted through, you know, whether
the parents,
exactly, he got through, you know, and, you know, Milton Berle had him on, and, you know, Steve Allen had him on, a lot of people, I think, and it was really interesting.
That reminds me of a question I wanted to ask you. The Young Rascals never made a movie or made any.
Almost.
You almost made a movie.
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, I wanted to make a movie really badly, you know, and what I did is I just mentioned his name, but I went to L.A. and I got to meet Steve Allen and his wife, Jane, and I asked him if he would be interested in directing a movie for us. And he did say yes.
Oh, my God.
And then we had to find a script, you know, and that's where we kind of faltered because, you know, I was a young guy, you know what I'm saying? I mean, I needed help. I needed somebody that knew how to find a script. You know, and then of course you have to find someone to pay for the wonderful thing, you know, and I really needed help. And that's where I really needed like Sid and, you know, the people, you know, kind of like that were managing us to jump in and help out. But I did what I could. I didn't know how to go about that. So we couldn't find a script. Otherwise we would have had a movie.
Missed opportunity. Cause that sounds like it would have been a funny picture.
I think they should change the name of the band instead of the rest. Let's call it the Missed Opportunities. Because, yeah, we missed a lot of opportunities. We're still missing opportunities. It's really sad. You know, it's just really sad, but that's life. Hey, we're good. You know, we're breathing.
I mean, it's not sad in the sense that you made some brilliant records that will live on forever.
Well, I mean, just to give you an example, like, for example, in those days, we were approached to do the first Broadway rock and roll show before Jesus Christ Superstar, before Hair.
Wow.
And I said to my then writing partner, wow, what do you think, man? I mean, there's something about being first. Let me tell you, even if it's a flop, we're first. And his answer was to me, don't we work hard enough?
No.
And I said, wait a minute. This is work? You call this work? This is work, huh? We go, we write a song, becomes number one. You know what I mean? We go on the road, people yell and scream for, this is what you call work? I'll show you what work is. Matter of fact, his dad showed him what work is. This is not work. This is a joy. But people didn't want to work. They didn't want to do it. He didn't want to do it, so we never did it. But, you know, those missed opportunities, okay. So somebody beat us to the punch and, you know, there it is. Jesus Christ Superstar. Here.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I saw your show that you toured with a little while ago in San Francisco, which is kind of a multimedia story of the Rascals. That was on Broadway as well, right?
Yeah, that's really what it was about. It was started on Broadway and, it should have really stayed on Broadway, in my opinion. It was too big a production to take on the road.
Well, I'm glad that you brought it to San Francisco because...
I am too. You know, as I say, I just wish we could have continued it with a little different kind of format. If we had, you know, brought it down a little bit, you know, it would have been much more successful, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And now you're going to be touring with Mickey Dolenz. So that should be fun.
Well, I think so. You know, I think that it, as far as from a musical point of view, the music that they put out and the music that we put out is pretty happy music, you know. And I think, boy, what's going on in our planet right now, we could use a little happy music. After COVID and now with this going on overseas, I think it's time for people to, you know, just have a little fun and kind of like fond kind of feelings and memories. So that's the point of it anyway.
Well, and you've got a new memoir, and it's called Memoir of a Rascal. Of course, it's called that.
Could be. It could, yes, exactly.
And congratulations on that. And I'm looking forward to reading it. And it's just been an honor to spend some time talking with you, Felix Cavallari. Thank you so much.
Gary, thank you so much for your time and your patience here, because it's been a really interesting time being alive right now, and I'm glad to be able to share some of my one of my moments with you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.